The Social Contract by Jean-Jacques Rousseau, first published in 1762. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Book 1. In this little treatise, I plan to address the question, with men as they are and with laws as they could be, can there be in the civil order any sure and legitimate rule of administration? In tackling this, I shall try always to unite what right allows with what interest demands, so that justice and utility don't at any stage part company. I start on this without showing that the subject is important. You may want to challenge me. So you want to write on politics. Are you then a monarch or a legislator? I answer that I am neither, and that is why I write on politics. If I were a monarch or a legislator, I wouldn't waste my time saying what should be done. I would do it, or keep quiet. As I was born a citizen of a free state, and am a member of its sovereign body, my right to vote makes it my duty to study public affairs, however little influence my voice can have on them. Happily, when I think about governments, I always find that my inquiries give me new reasons for loving the government of my own country. Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains. He is one who thinks he is the master of others, yet he is more enslaved than they are. How did this change come about? I don't know. What can make it legitimate? That's a question I think I can answer. If I took into account nothing but force, and what can be done by force, I would say, as long as a people is constrained to obey, it does well to obey. As soon as it can shake off the yoke, it does even better to shake it off. If its right to do so is challenged, it can answer that it gets its liberty back by the same so-called right, namely force, that took its liberty from it in the first place. Any justification for taking it away equally justifies taking it back. And if there was no justification for its being taken away, no justification for taking it back is called for. But the social order isn't to be understood in terms of force. It is a sacred right on which all other rights are based. But it doesn't come from nature, so it must be based on agreements. Before coming to that, though, I have to establish the truth of what I have been saying. The first societies. The most ancient of all societies, and the only natural one, is the society of the family. Yet the children remain attached to the father only for as long as they need him for their preservation. As soon as this need ceases, the natural bond is dissolved. The children, released from the obedience they owed to the father, and the father, released from the care he owed his children, return equally to independence. If they remain united, they do so not naturally, but voluntarily, and the family itself is then maintained only by agreement. This common liberty is an upshot of the nature of man. His first law is to provide for his own preservation. His first cares are those he owes to himself. And as soon as he can think for himself, he is the sole judge of the right way to take care of himself, which makes him his own master. You could call the family the prime model of political societies. The ruler corresponds to the father, and the people to the children, and all of them, the people and the children, because they were born free and equal, don't give up their liberty without getting something in return. The whole difference is that in the family, the father's care for his children is repaid by his love for them, whereas in the state, the ruler's care for the people under him is repaid not by love for them, which he doesn't have, but by the pleasure of being in command. The legal theorist Hugo Grotius denies that all human power is established in favour of the governed, and cites slavery as a counterexample. His usual method of reasoning is to establish right by fact, that is, to draw conclusions about what should be the case from premises about what is the case. Not the most logical of argument patterns, but it's one that is very favourable to tyrants. Throughout his book, Grotius seems to be inclined, as does Hobbes, to the thesis that the human species is divided into so many herds of cattle, each with a ruler who keeps guard over them for the purpose of devouring them. Aristotle, long before, said that men are not naturally equal, because some are born for slavery and others for command. He was right, but he mistook the effect for the cause. Every man born in slavery is born for slavery. Nothing is more certain than that. Slaves lose everything in their chains, even the desire to escape from them. They love their servitude, as Ulysses, comrades, loved their brutish condition when the goddess Circe turned them into pigs. So if there are slaves by nature, that's because there have been slaves against nature. Force first made them slaves, and their cowardice kept them slaves. I have said nothing about King Adam, or about Emperor Noah, the father of three great monarchs, who are said in the book of Genesis to have ruled the world after the flood. I hope to be given credit for my moderation, as a direct descendant of one of these monarchs, perhaps of the eldest branch. I don't know that a verification of titles wouldn't show me to be the legitimate king of the human race. Anyway, Adam was undeniably sovereign of the world, as Robinson Crusoe was of his island, as long as he was its only inhabitant, and this empire had the advantage that the monarch, safe on his throne, had nothing to fear from rebellions, wars, or conspirators. The right of the strongest. The strongest is never strong enough to be always the master, unless he transforms strength into right and obedience into duty. Hence the right of the strongest, a phrase that one might think is meant ironically, but is actually laid down as a basic truth. But will no one ever explain this phrase? Force is a physical power. I don't see what moral effect it can have. Giving way to force is something you have to do, not something you choose to do. Or if you insist the choice comes into it, it is at most an act of prudence. In what sense can it be a duty? Suppose for a moment that this so-called right of the strongest exists. I maintain that we'll get out of this nothing but a mass of inexplicable nonsense. If force makes right, then if you change the force, you change the right. Effects change when causes change. So that when one force overcomes another, there's a corresponding change in what is right. The moment it becomes possible to disobey with impunity, it becomes possible to disobey legitimately. And because the strongest are always in the right, the only thing that matters is to work to become the strongest. Now, what sort of right is it that perishes when force fails? If force makes us obey, we can't be morally obliged to obey. And if force doesn't make us obey, then on the theory now being discussed, we are under no obligation to do so. Clearly, the word right adds nothing to force. In this context, it doesn't stand for anything. Obey the powers that be. If this means submit to force, it is a good precept, but superfluous. I guarantee that it will never be violated. All power comes from God, I admit. But so does all sickness. Are we then forbidden to send for the doctor? A robber confronts me at the edge of a wood. I am compelled to hand over my money. But is it the case that even if I could hold on to it, I am morally obliged to hand it over? After all, the pistol he holds is also a power. Then let us agree that force doesn't create right, and that legitimate powers are the only ones we are obliged to obey, which brings us back to my original question. Slavery. Since no man has a natural authority over his fellow, and force creates no right, we are left with agreements as the basis for all legitimate authority among men. Grotius says, "If an individual can get rid of his liberty and make himself the slave of a master, why couldn't a whole people get rid of its liberty and make itself subject to a king?" This contains several ambiguous expressions that need to be explained, but let us confine ourselves to get rid of. To get rid of something is to give or sell it. Now, a man who becomes the slave of another does not give himself. He sells himself at the rock-bottom price of his subsistence, his bare means of survival. But when a people sells itself, what price is paid? Not their subsistence. Far from providing his subjects with their subsistence, a king gets his own subsistence entirely from them. Do subjects, then, give their persons on condition that the king takes their goods also? I fail to see what they have left to preserve. The despot guarantees civic peace in the state, you may say. Granted, but what do the people gain if the wars his ambition brings down on them, his insatiable greed and harassments by his government bring them more misery than they'd have suffered from their own ungoverned quarrels? What do they gain if this peace is one of their miseries? You can live peacefully in a dungeon, but does that make it a good life? To say that a man gives himself to someone else, that is, hands himself over free of charge, is to say something absurd and inconceivable. Such an act is null and illegitimate, simply because the man who does it is out of his mind. To say the same of a whole people is to suppose a people of madmen, and madness doesn't create any right. Even if each man could get rid of himself, he couldn't get rid of his children. They are born men and born free. Their liberty belongs to them, and no one else has the right to dispose of it. While they are too young to decide for themselves, the father can, in their name, lay down conditions for their preservation and well-being. But he can't make an irrevocable and unconditional gift of them. Such a gift is contrary to the ends of nature, and exceeds the rights of paternity. To renounce your liberty is to renounce your status as a man, your rights as a human being, and even your duties. There can't be any way of compensating someone who gives up everything. Such a renunciation is incompatible with man's nature. To remove all freedom from his will is to remove all morality from his actions. Finally, an agreement, to have absolute authority on one side and unlimited obedience on the other, what an empty and contradictory agreement that would have to be! Isn't it clear that if we are entitled to take anything and everything from a person, we can't be under any obligation to him? And isn't that fact alone, that there is no equivalence, nothing to be exchanged between the two sides, enough to nullify the agreement? What right can my slave have against me? Everything that he has is mine. His right is mine. And it doesn't make sense to speak of my right against myself. Grotius and Company cite war as another source for the so-called right of slavery, the winner having, they say, the right to kill the loser. The latter can buy back his life at the price of his freedom, and this agreement is all the more legitimate in being to the advantage of both parties. But this supposed right to kill the loser is clearly not an upshot of the state of war. Men are not naturally one another's enemies. Any natural relations amongst them must exist when they are living in their primitive independence without any government or social structure, but at that time they have no interrelations stable enough to constitute either the state of peace or the state of war. War is constituted by a relation between things, not between persons. And because the state of war can't arise out of simple personal relations, but only out of thing relations, there can't be a private war, a war of man against man, in the state of nature, where there is no ownership, or in the state of society, where everything is under the authority of the laws. Individual combats, duels, and encounters are acts that can't constitute a state. The private wars authorized by Louis IX of France were abuses of feudal government, which was itself an absurd system, if ever there was one, contrary to the principles of natural right and to all good government. So war is a relation not between man and man, but between state and state. And individuals are enemies only accidentally, not as men, nor even as citizens, but as soldiers, not as belonging to their country, but as defenders of it. and the only enemies a state can have are other states, not men, because there can't be a real settled relation between things as radically different as states and men. This principle squares with the established rules of all times, and the constant practice of all civilized peoples. Declarations of war don't give notice to powers as much as to their subjects. A foreigner, whether king, individual, or whole people, who robs, kills, or detains the subjects of a country without first declaring war on their monarch, is not an enemy, but a bandit. During a full-scale war, a monarch is entitled to help himself to anything in the enemy country that belongs to the public, but if he is just, he will respect the lives and goods of individuals. He will respect rights on which his own are based. The purpose of the war is to destroy the enemy state, so we have a right to kill its defenders while they are bearing arms. But as soon as they lay down their weapons and surrender, they stop being enemies or instruments of the enemy, and resume their status as simply men, and no one has any right to take their lives. Sometimes it is possible to kill a state without killing any of its members, and a war doesn't give any right that isn't needed for the war to gain its objective. What about the right of conquest? The only basis for that is the law of the strongest. If war doesn't give the winner the right to massacre the conquered peoples, you can't cite that non-existent right as a basis for a right to enslave those peoples. No one has a right to kill an enemy except when he can't make him a slave. So the right to enslave him can't be derived from the right to kill him. It's not fair dealing to make him spend his freedom so as to keep his life, over which the victor holds no right. Isn't it clear that there is a vicious circle in basing the right of life and death on the right of slavery, and the right of slavery on the right of life and death? Even if we assume this terrible right to kill all the conquered people, I maintain that someone enslaved in war isn't committed to do anything for his master except what he is compelled to do. And the same goes for a conquered people. The enslaved individual or the conquered people doesn't owe the conqueror anything. By taking an equivalent for the conquered person's life, the winner hasn't done him a favour. Instead of killing him without profit, he has killed him usefully. He is, indeed, so far from getting any authority over the slave, in addition to his power over him, that the two are still in a state of war towards one another. Their master-slash-slave relation comes from that, and this enforcement of a right of war doesn't imply that there has been a peace treaty. They have reached an agreement, but this agreement, far from ending the state of war, presupposes its continuance. However we look at it, therefore, the right of slavery is null and void, not only as illegitimate but also as absurd and meaningless. The words slave and right contradict each other and are mutually exclusive. It will always be insane to say to a man or to a people, "I make an agreement with you wholly at your expense and wholly to my advantage. I shall keep it as long as I like, and you will keep it as long as I like." The need for a first agreement. Even if I granted everything that I have refuted up to here, the supporters of despotism would be no better off. Ruling a society will always be a quite different thing from subduing a multitude. If any number of scattered individuals were successively enslaved by one man, I can see that only a master and his slaves, not a people and its ruler. It's a cluster, if you will, but not an association. There's no public good there, and no body politic. This man may have enslaved half the world, but he is still only an individual. His interest, apart from that of the others, is never anything but a purely private interest. When this man dies, the empire he leaves behind him will remain scattered and without unity, like an oak that falls into a fire and dissolves into a heap of ashes when the fire has consumed it. A people, says Grotius, can give itself to a king, so he must hold that a people is a people before it gives itself to a king. This gift is itself a civic act, which has to arise from public deliberation. before we examine the act by which a people gives itself to a king, let us examine the previous act by which the people became a people, this being the true foundation of society. Indeed, if there were no prior agreement, what would give the minority any obligation to submit to the choice of the majority, unless the election was unanimous? 100 men want to have a master. What gives them the right to vote on behalf of 10 who don't? The law of majority voting is itself something established by agreement, and it presupposes that on at least one occasion there was a unanimous vote. The Social Compact. Let us take it that men have reached the point at which the obstacles to their survival in the state of nature overpower each individual's resources for maintaining himself in that state. So this primitive condition can't go on. The human race will perish unless it changes its manner of existence. Now, men can't create new forces. They can only bring together ones that already exist and steer them. So their only way to preserve themselves is to unite a number of forces so that they are jointly powerful enough to deal with the obstacles. They have to bring these forces into play in such a way that they act together in a single thrust. For forces to add up in this way, many people have to work together. But each man's force and liberty are what he chiefly needs for his own survival. So how can he put them into this collective effort without harming his own interests and neglecting the care he owes to himself? This difficulty, and the version of it that arises from my present subject, can be put like this. Find a form of association that will bring the whole common force to bear on defending and protecting each associate's person and goods, doing this in such a way that each of them, while uniting himself with all, still obeys only himself and remains as free as before. There's the basic problem that is solved by the social contract. The clauses of this contract are so settled by the nature of the act that the slightest change would make them null and void, so that although they may never have been explicitly stated, they are everywhere the same and everywhere tacitly accepted and recognized, until the social compact is violated and each individual regains his original rights and resumes his natural liberty, while losing the liberty by agreement that had been his reason for announcing them. Properly understood, these clauses come down to one. Each associate totally gives himself and all his rights to the whole community. This may seem drastic, but three features of it make it reasonable. First, because each individual gives himself entirely, what is happening here for any one individual is the same as what is happening for each of the others, so that no one has any interest in making things tougher for everyone but himself. Second, the handing over is made without anything being held back. The union is as complete as it can be, and no associate has anything more to demand. To see why the association has to be done in this way, consider what the situation would be if the individuals retained certain rights. In the absence of any superior to decide issues about this, each individual would be his own judge in the first case that came up, and this would lead him to ask to be his own judge across the board. This would continue the state of nature, and the association would necessarily become inoperative or tyrannical. Third, each man, in giving himself to everyone, gives himself to no one, and the right over himself that the others get is matched by the right that he gets over each of them. So he gains as much as he loses, and also gains extra force for the preservation of what he has. Filtering out the inessentials, we'll find that the social compact comes down to this. Each of us puts his person and all his power in common under the supreme direction of the general will, and in our corporate capacity we receive each member as an indivisible part of the whole. This act of association instantly replaces the individual person status of each contracting party by a moral and collective body, composed of as many members as the assembly has votes, and it receives from this act its unity, its common identity, its life, and its will. This public person that is formed by the union of all the other persons was in earlier times called a city, and these days is called a republic, or a body politic. Its members call it a state, when thinking of it as passive, a sovereign, when thinking of it as active, and a power, when setting it alongside others of the same kind. Those associated in it are collectively called a people, and are separately called citizens, as sharing in the sovereign power, and subjects, as being under the state's laws. But these terms are often muddled and confused with one another. It is enough to know how to distinguish them when they are being used with precision. The sovereign body. This formula shows us that the act of association involves a two-way commitment between the public and the individuals belonging to it, and that each individual, in making a contract with himself, so to speak, acquires two commitments. As a member of the state, he has a commitment to the sovereign body, and as a member of the sovereign body, he has a commitment to each of the individuals, he being one of them. In civil law, no one is bound by undertakings he has made to himself. But what we are considering here is not that, not incurring an obligation to oneself, but incurring an obligation to a whole of which one is a part, which is very different. The proceeding I have been describing can't give the sovereign body a commitment to itself. As an individual, someone has a commitment to the sovereign body, and as a member of it, he has a commitment to himself. But the sovereign body can't have a commitment to itself. It doesn't have two distinct roles, such that a commitment could go from it in one role and towards it in the other. And so it is against the nature of the body politic for the sovereign body to impose on itself a law that it can't infringe. There isn't, and can't be, any kind of basic law that is binding on the body of the people. Even the social contract itself can't do that. This doesn't mean that the body politic can't enter into commitments with other states. It can do that, because in relation to what is external to it, that is, in relation to other states or sovereigns, the sovereign body is just a simple being, an individual. But the body politic, the sovereign body, owes its very existence to the sanctity of the contract, so it can never commit itself, even to another state, to do anything that conflicts with that original act. For example, to get rid of any part of itself, or to submit to another sovereign. I'm saying not that the sovereign body ought not to do such a thing, but that it can't do so. Violation of the act of contract-making by which it exists would be self-annihilation, and nothing can be created by something that has gone out of existence. As soon as this multitude is united into one body in this way, any offence against one of the members is an attack on the body, and any offence against the body will be resented by the members. Thus, the two contracting parties, the individual member and the body politic, are obliged by duty and by self-interest to give each other help. Now, because the sovereign body is made out of nothing but its constituent individuals, it doesn't and can't have any interest contrary to theirs. So there's no need for it to provide its subjects with guarantees of treating them well, because the body can't possibly wish to hurt all its members, and, as we'll see later on, it can't hurt any individual one of them either. The sovereign body, merely by virtue of what it is always what it ought to be. But the situation is different with respect to the relation of the subjects to the sovereign body. Despite the subjects' common interest, the sovereign body would have no security that they would behave as they have committed themselves to behaving, unless it found some way to be assured of their fidelity. The fact is that each individual as a man can have a particular will that doesn't fit, and even conflicts with, the general will he has as a citizen. His individual self-interest may speak to him quite differently from how the common interest does. He looks at the situation in this way. I have an absolute and naturally independent existence. I'm not something that exists only because certain items have come together in an association. So what I am said to owe to the common cause, that is, to the body politic or sovereign body, whose existence is in that way dependent on the conduct of its members, is really a gift, a handout. If I withhold it, that won't harm anyone else as much as it will benefit me. So he wants to enjoy the rights of a citizen without being ready to fulfil the duties of a subject, and in due course that injustice would destroy the body politic. To protect the social compact from being a mere empty formula, therefore, it silently includes the undertaking that anyone who refuses to obey the general will is to be compelled to do so by the whole body. This single item in the compact can give power to all the rest. It means nothing less than that each individual will be forced to be free. It's obvious how forcing comes into this, but to be free? Yes, because this is the condition which, by giving each citizen to his country, secures him against being taken by anyone or anything else. This is the key to the working of the political machine. It alone legitimizes civil commitments, which would otherwise be absurd, tyrannical, and liable to frightful abuses. The civil state. This shift from the state of nature to the civil state produces a very remarkable change in man. The role that instinct used to play in his conduct is now taken over by a sense of justice, and his actions now have a moral aspect that they formerly lacked. The voice of duty has taken over from physical impulses, and a sense of what is right has taken over from appetite. And now, only now, the man who previously considered only himself discovers that he is forced to act on different principles, and to consult his reason before listening to his inclinations. In this civil state, he is deprived of many advantages that he received from nature, but he gets enormous benefits in return. His faculties are so stimulated and developed, his ideas are extended, his feelings ennobled, and his whole soul uplifted to such a level that if the misuses of this new condition didn't often pull him down lower than he was in the state of nature, he would be bound to bless continually the happy moment that took him from it for ever, turning a dull and limited animal into a thinking being, a man. Here is a statement of profit and loss, in terms that make it easy to compare the two sides. What man loses by the social contract is his natural liberty and an unrestricted right to anything he wants and can get. And what he gains is civil liberty and the ownership of everything he possesses. If we're to weigh these up accurately, we must distinguish natural liberty, which is limited only by the individual's powers, from civil liberty, which is limited by the general will. And we must distinguish possession, which is merely the effect of force or the principle of first come, first served, from ownership, which can only be based on a positive title. We could add on the profit side the fact that in the civil state a man acquires moral liberty, which alone makes him truly master of himself. For the drive of sheer appetite is slavery, while obedience to a law that we prescribe to ourselves is liberty. But I've said too much about this in other places, and the philosophical meaning of the word liberty doesn't concern us here. Real estate. At the moment when the community comes into existence, each of its members gives himself to it. Himself, just as he is, with all his powers, including all his possessions. It is not the case that this transfer of all his goods changes them from being possessions in his hands to being property in the hands of the sovereign body, that is, to being strictly owned by it. But because the city's powers are incomparably greater than any individual's, public possession is stronger and more irrevocable, without being any more legitimate. Actually, this state's possession of its own members' goods is legitimate, because the state is the master of all their goods by the social contract, which is the basis of all rights within the state. But that doesn't hold for foreigners, because for them ownership depends solely on the first-come, first-served principle, which also serves for states in their ownership of territory. Of the two ways of getting a right to something in the state of nature, namely, being the first occupier of it, and being the strongest, the former provides a right, first come, first served, that is more real than what the latter provides, but it doesn't become a true right until property rights are established. Every man has naturally a right to everything he needs, but the positive act that makes something his property makes him the owner of it, excludes him from everything else. Having acquired a share, he ought to limit himself to that, and can't have any further claim on the community. That's why the first occupier right, which is so weak in the state of nature, claims the respect of every man in civil society. What a man respects in this right is not so much what does belong to someone else as what does not belong to him. In general, to authorize a first occupier's right over any bit of ground, three conditions must be satisfied. The ground wasn't already occupied by someone else. He occupies only as much as he needs for his subsistence. He takes possession of this ground not by an empty ceremony, but by labour and cultivation. His work on the land is the only sign of ownership that others should respect if he doesn't have a legal title. In allowing the right of first occupancy on condition that the land was needed and was worked on, aren't we stretching that right as far as it can go? Can no restrictions be placed on such a right? To claim to be the master of a plot of common ground, will it be enough merely to set foot on it? If a man has the strength to expel others for a moment, does that deprive them of any right to return? If a man or a people seize an immense territory and shut out the rest of the world, won't this be merely a grab that ought to be punished? The answer is surely yes, because such an act steals from others the living space and means of subsistence that nature gave them in common. When Balboa stood on the seashore and took possession of the South Seas and the whole of South America in the name of the Spanish crown, was that enough to dispossess all their actual inhabitants, and to shut out from those territories all the monarchs of the world? If so, there's no need for all these ceremonies. The Catholic king can take possession of the whole universe all at once, tacking on a rider, excluding from his claim any territories that were already possessed by other monarchs. We can imagine how adjacent pieces of land belonging to individuals become when they are combined, public territory, and how the right of sovereignty over the subjects comes to be extended to being a right over their real estate. This makes the landowners even more dependent on the sovereign. They have more to lose if things go wrong between them and the sovereign. And this is a guarantee of their fidelity. The advantage of this apparently wasn't felt by ancient monarchs, who called themselves kings of the Persians, the Scythians, or the Macedonians, apparently regarding themselves as rulers of men rather than as masters of a country. Today's kings are cleverer. They call themselves kings of France, of Spain, of England, and so on. Holding the land in this way, they are quite confident of holding the inhabitants. This alienation, in which individuals transfer their goods to the community, has a special feature, namely that far from depriving the individuals of their goods, it assures them of legitimate possession, changing "I have taken possession of this somehow" into "I have a genuine right to this," and changing "I have the enjoyment of this" into "I own this." Thus the possessors, in their role as those to whom the public good has been entrusted, and having their rights respected by all the state's members and maintained against foreign aggression by all its forces, have made a transfer that benefits both the public and still more themselves, thereby acquiring, as it were, everything that they gave up. This paradox is easily explained by distinguishing the sovereign body's right from the owner's rights over the same estate, as we shall see later on. It can also happen that men begin to unite before they possess anything, subsequently occupy a tract of land that is enough for them all, and then enjoy it in common, or share it out amongst themselves, either equally or in proportions fixed by the sovereign body. However the acquisition is made, each individual's right to his own estate is always subordinate to the community's right over everyone's estate. Without this, the social tie would be fragile, and the exercise of sovereignty would be feeble. To bring this book to an end, I'll remark on a fact that should be the basis for any social system, namely, the basic compact doesn't destroy natural inequality. Rather, it replaces such physical inequalities as nature may have set up between men by an equality that is moral and legitimate, so that men who may be unequal in strength or intelligence become equal by agreement and legal right. Under bad governments, this equality is only apparent and illusory. All it does is to keep the pauper in his poverty, and the rich man in the position he has usurped. Laws, in fact, are always useful to those who have possessions, and harmful to those who don't, from which it follows that the social state is advantageous to men only when everyone has something, and no one has too much. End of Book 1.